How many of you know who I am? Okay, you know my name. I just told you my name. How many of you know anything about me? Aside from the beautiful lady in purple. We've only lived here in Hermiston for a year and a half. So I'm going to guess you probably don't know that much about me. All right, so Connie and Dennis went to school with my brother and my sister. So there's a tie. But does that mean you know anything about me? Okay. So you guys are actually playing right into my hands here this morning. I can tell you anything about me, and you'll have to believe me, right? I mean, absent any other evidence, you're going to have to believe what I tell you. So, I could probably tell you about my secret work with the CIA. I could tell you, but then I'd have to shoot you. I could tell you about all those years I spent working for NASA, designing the space shuttle. Glorious years they were. Or I could tell you about my adventuresome self, that time that I took and rode a canoe from Seattle to Tokyo in 3 days. Or I could tell you the truth. And the truth is that in what now seems like a previous lifetime, I was a nurse. That was my first profession. I was a nurse. How many of you have read the autobiography of Mark Twain? Again, just the pretty lady in purple. He starts the book with the most fascinating statement. He says, "When I was young, I could remember everything, whether it had happened or not. And now that I am old, I fear I can only remember those things that never happened." And then he writes the book, and you're left wondering, did this happen or not? But the stories in the book are so full of pathos that you just know they're true. Now, one of the stories he told was of a friend of his when he was just a young boy growing up in Hannibal, Missouri. The two of them were constantly getting into trouble, trying all sorts of different things, daring each other to do this or that. And one winter, it was a cold winter, much like they're having now, and the Mississippi River froze very nearly all the way across. And as they sat there on the bank one day, Sam Clemens, was his real name, of course, his friend said, "Sam, I'll bet you can't make it 10 feet out from the shore before the ice breaks." Sam says, "I'll bet you can't make it 20. And you know how it goes, back and forth. You've been dared, I've been dared. Well, we better do it. So they set out together a little further. And then their confidence was built because they actually were about 50 feet from the shore and it hadn't broke yet. So it must be good ice, right? That was when they heard the crack. That was when the ice parted from beneath their feet. And that was when they plunged into the cold Mississippi River. Sam's friend hit his head on the edge of the ice as he fell. And then he slipped into the water for what seemed an interminably long period of time. He finally came back up. The both of them were able to scramble. They got back onto the ice. They ran for shore. And they both survived, but the cold water and the knock on the head proved fatal to the hearing of Sam's friend. He went completely deaf. Years later, their paths happened to cross again. Two old men sitting on a park bench reminiscing about the old days by writing messages to each other. And toward the end of their visit, Sam's friend leaned over, motioned that he wanted to whisper something into Sam's ear. And then in what Sam describes as a whisper that could be heard across the Mississippi at flood stage, he said, "It was a grand adventure, wasn't it? It was a grand adventure." When you're deaf, I guess you can't know how loud your whispers are. Some whispers aren't whispers at all. 1976, Mary and I were working at a little hospital just over the hill from here, Grand Ronde Hospital in La Grande. We like to call it Ground Round Hospital because of all of the car accidents and logging accidents that we saw there. I was assigned that night to the surgical floor, but in small hospitals, you know, you're often called to go and pick up a task here and there, float from position to position. And so it was on that summer evening, about 2 hours into my 3 to 11 shift, beautiful summer evening, generally slow evening for me. I had a couple of recent post-op patients, a couple of pre-op patients that were set for surgeries in the morning. That was the day where you were in the hospital the night before your surgery instead of just walking in the next day. Nothing very taxing. There was plenty of time for me to stand around and talk, which is a sport that I'm rather adept at. I was passing out the dinner trays when I got a page from the ER. "Can you come down here and help us? We've got a guy coming in the ambulance, 46 years old, complaining of chest pains. We just need you to help lift him out of the ambulance and get him onto a gurney so we can check him out." I said, "Sure." So I went down there. I got there before the ambulance. I stood just outside those big glass doors, the hospital's up on the side of a hill, looked out over the valley and watched the city. That beautiful summer evening, the sun was warm. Pretty soon I could hear the ambulance coming up the hill, the sirens going. And soon enough, I was staring into the face of a man that I had never met. We all reached out. We assisted in getting him out of the ambulance and onto the ER gurney. There were two nurses in the ER that night. One of them began attaching leads for a heart monitor. The other was trying to get an IV started. The paramedics had tried. They hadn't been able to find a vein. My job was done, really. I had just been asked to help lift, so I turned around and I started to leave. And that's when I heard one of them yell, "He's coding." He's coding. Well, that's a term that generally galvanizes the nursing crew into action. Ours was no exception. There were only the three of us in the room, the nurse starting the IV, the nurse attaching EKG leads, and me. The doctor wasn't there yet. He was still on his way from the other end of the hospital. Like the others, I had been trained to react, and so I did. I jumped up, and I started pumping the man's chest. The EKG nurse grabbed an Ambu bag. She started methodically breathing for the patient, while the nurse who was starting the IV kept doing her work because she knew that was going to be needed here very quickly. The doctor finally arrived, quietly assessed the situation, barked a few orders, and I kept pumping the man's chest. It's actually harder work than it appears to be. The doctor then grabbed the paddles, he set the charge himself, he told me to stand back, and he shot a current right through the man's heart. Nothing. I pumped a few more times while he set the machine to a higher charge. He yelled at me to clear again. I stepped back as I watched the man get a bolt of electricity through him that arced his back up off the table. Nothing. There was nothing on the heart monitor except what I was creating with my hands. His blood pressure was falling. His pupils were fixed and dilated. I kept working. I remember the sweat pouring off my forehead, falling onto my glasses, and then dripping down onto the bare chest of the man who I was keeping alive with my bare hands. 10 minutes went by. 12, 15, a total of 5 defibrillation attempts, epinephrine IV push, nothing. I kept pumping. My arms felt like lead weights, like maybe they were no longer attached to me. And then it happened. He opened his eyes, and he looked at me. He looked confused, like he didn't quite know what was going on. And he tried to talk to me, but I couldn't understand what he said. And I looked over at the EKG monitor, and it was a flat line. And I looked back. His eyes were closed, and this time for good. 22 minutes after we started CPR, the doctor called the time of death for the official record and told us it was over. He thanked us for our efforts, and then he, with heavy steps, headed for the waiting room to talk to the family. And I stood there, staring into the colorless face of a man I'd never met. One of the ER nurses blandly asked, "Who was he?" I don't know. Nobody did. And I remember thinking how quickly he had gone from, "Who is he?" to, "Who was he?" Oh, he was just a guy. Rode up in an ambulance, handed over to us for a time, then moved on without saying a word. He was gone. I didn't even know who he was. I was pretty young at the time. I was probably, 22 years old? But I had been in nursing long enough that I had lost patients before. Too many of them, probably. I had been there when lives slipped away after long lingering illnesses. I had been waiting for surgical patients when word came down that there had been complications in surgery. I had actually been covered in that very ER room with blood after car wrecks left us very little to work with. But I had never literally held a man's life in my hands, had him look me in the eye and try to speak, and then die. I felt cheated. I was angry. How dare he do that after all we had done to try to save him? We had worked hard. We were sweaty and tired and confused and just doing our jobs. We just wanted everything to work out all right in the end. Didn't even know his name. Who was he? You know, Scripture says that like the grass that's here today and tomorrow is thrown into the fire, our lives are tenuous at best. Even with all of our technological advances, we do not hold the keys to life. God holds the keys to life. In fact, God is life. Apart from God, there is no life. It's just that simple. God is the sine qua non of life. And that's why in 1 John 5:12 it says, "He who has the Son of life, has the Son, has life. He who does not have the Son of God does not have life." It was God who gave us life in the beginning. It's God who sustains our lives every day. And it is God who has promised us, to those who believe, a life beyond the life we're now living. 1 John 2:25, this is what he has promised us, eternal life. Never did find out that man's name. You know, I'm comforted in a way to know that God knew it then and he knows it now. I don't know if the man was rich or a pauper. I don't know if he was generous or stingy, compassionate or selfish, loving or lonely, a believer or an agnostic, but God knows. And I believe in my heart that in that man's 46 years of life, God afforded him every opportunity for him to make the right decision, either for God or against, for the world. What decisions he had made, I don't know. But God knows. I know this. I know he was a sinner, because all of us have fallen short of the glory of God. And I know this, sin separates us from God. It separates us from the God of life. Apart from God, we have no control over life. The person who holds on to his sins is dead, even if his heart keeps beating. And the person who falls on his knees seeking God's forgiveness will find it in abundance and will find his life sustained even if his heart stops beating, because there is more. The man on that gurney in the ER in Grand Run Hospital had made his choices. I just don't know what they were. I didn't even know his name. But that man's life, or rather his death, changed my life in more ways than I can measure. I've relived that event many times throughout my life. And every time I can hear God whispering to me, and he says, I'm in control. Life isn't yours to give. I know that man's name. I know his family. I gave him opportunities just as many as I'm giving you. I know what choices he made. What choices are you making? Some whispers aren't whispers. If he died in Jesus Christ, he will live again. I am completely confident of that. And there will be no need for any more tears in the waiting room. And if faithful, I may yet have the opportunity of knowing that man's name and meeting him and telling him face to face how much God used his death to help me choose life. Same hospital, about 4 weeks later. Same shift, 3 to 11. A little later in the evening, I got word that I would be adding one patient to my list. A little boy had just come in through the ER and then gone straight to surgery. I had no details about the case, except I knew the boy was 7 years old. I got a room ready for him. I guided his mother there to await his arrival from surgery. She had been crying, but bravely tried to smile as I offered her whatever I could. From the mother, I learned the details of the case. It seemed that what she had said would happen had happened. She had told that little boy the very same thing your mother undoubtedly told you, and the very same thing, if you are a mother, you probably told your kids. Don't run with scissors, because you could fall and poke your eye out. The little boy had proven his mother right. Not that being proved right made her feel good. She tried to read, tried to watch TV, but her mind was clearly on the activity down the hall and to the left just after the swinging double doors with the little round windows. An hour went by, and then two, and then three. And by then, she was desperate for any word at all. She begged with me, find out what you can. So I walked down the hall, And I passed through the swinging doors, and I turned left, and I stuck my head in the surgery room, and I asked for a quick report. Nobody looked up, but the doctor said, "Well, you can go and tell her we were able to save the eye, but he's going to have to wear glasses for the rest of his life." So I went back and I told her. Pretty simple message, really. She anxiously jumped to her feet as I entered the room, and as she digested the information, she slumped back into her chair with tension-releasing tears pouring down her face. The relief spread across her face. And then suddenly, out of nowhere, she jumped up out of her chair, and she bounded across the room, and she grabbed me in a hug tighter than I have ever been hugged in my life, and she kissed me. And my wife was just working down the hall a few feet away. You never know what a mother's going to do when she catches one of those waves. But I can tell you, that wave she caught was contagious. I caught it. I worked the rest of that shift with a smile on my face. I'm not sure my feet ever hit the ground. I had not cared for that boy in ER. I hadn't saved his eye. I had not attended to his needs before surgery. I had not even met him. But I was lucky enough to be chosen to pass along a little message. A message which changed someone's life forever. And I felt like I had saved the world. I was the one who was blessed. And I could hear God whispering again, saying, "You don't have to be the hero." I hadn't saved that boy's sight, but it was my voice who brought joy to a fearful mother's heart. You don't have to have some grand and glorious conversion story to share in order to profoundly change people's lives. You don't even need to know all there is to know about God, or about the mystery of iniquity, or about eschatological events. You don't need to have all the answers. All you are asked to do is go and tell what you do know. The words may be few and simple, but they will change the world forever. Go and tell. That's all we've been asked to do. Because somewhere, there's a mother waiting to hear from you about life, about God, about salvation, about everything turning out all right in the end. 8 years later, another hospital, another town, Yakima, actually. The sign outside the room I was assigned to was red neon. It was not of the flashing variety. It read simply, "Emergency." And it was supposed to be advertising, I think, but that night it was not very effective. I was the entire nursing staff in that small ER that night. I had been on duty for nearly 3 hours without a single customer. Down the hall, all the other nurses were busy. They had things to do. They were caring for their patients. They were handing out dinner trays. They were hanging IVs. The lab people across the hall from me, they had work to do. Me, I had nothing. I was bored. All my routines had been taken care of right away. I'd stocked the med cabinet. I'd resupplied the crash cart. Place was neat and tidy, just like an ER is supposed to be. Neat and boring. The doctor on duty that evening stopped by and said he was heading off for supper. I said, well, take your time. Nothing going on around here. And I watched him walk down the gleaming hallway. I was about three-quarters of the way through an extremely outdated article in Sports Illustrated on Joe Montana when the ER doors banged open. I jumped to my feet, the magazine fell to the floor, I left it right there. It was the only thing out of place in that entire ER. There were three men, well, one man and two teenage boys, I guessed about 16 years of age. The adult and the shorter of the two teens were assisting their unsteady and obviously hurting companion, anxiety etched in the dirt on their faces. The one with the one child, his left arm, he was holding it tightly to his side, and his shoulder was pointing in a direction that God had never intended it to point. I directed them to the first treatment room, and in my best matter-of-fact voice, had them sit down. I remember thinking, something to do at last. ER nurses are, you know, a sadistic lot in a lot of ways, but we'll move beyond that for the moment. I helped get the grass-stained boy up onto the exam table, and the pure white paper crinkled when he sat down and immediately turned the color of the dirt on his pants. I asked them to tell me what had happened. They all wanted to talk at once, but through the machine-gunned words, I was able to piece it together. Todd was the injured one. They had all been playing a game of football in the park with Dave, the adult, and with Jim and several other kids. Tackle, of course, no protection of any sort. And on a simple down-and-out pattern, Todd had stretched to snag a pass that was poorly thrown, and he landed with his full weight on his outstretched arm. He wrenched the shoulder bone from the socket. He was in pain. I grabbed the phone, I punched in three numbers, and I told Doc that he was done eating supper. Todd was from out of town, Arizona. He had arrived only a couple of days earlier to visit his dad, from whom his mom had been divorced for several years. Dave was not his dad, so he was not able to give me the parental permissions I needed. So I grabbed the phone again, dialed Todd's dad, but he wasn't home. I left a message. By the time I hung up the phone, Doc had arrived. He was still chewing on something. He asked me to shoot Todd with 50 of Demerol before hauling him off to X-ray. I didn't expect what happened next. Todd, strong boy, steadfastly refused to take a shot. I thought, well, that's about the biggest 16-year-old wimp I've ever seen. Usually the kids that are afraid of needles are a lot younger. Doc tried to explain to Todd that the pain was going to be a little worse before it got any better, and that a small poke with a needle would be the least of his worries. But Todd was adamant. No shot, no way, period. Doc turned to me with a look that suggested I might want to look outside to see if it was a full moon or something. But then, just then, Todd's dad called back, and I briefed him on the situation. He gave me the verbal go-ahead to do whatever needed to be done. I also just mentioned to him that Todd was too afraid to take a shot. And Todd's dad said to me, that kid's not afraid of anything in this world. I walked Todd down the hall to X-ray. I didn't stay for the whole show, mostly because I knew it was not going to be pleasant. I heard about it later. In a nutshell, the process of getting the picture right caused considerable bending of the shoulder, which, without the Demerol, sent real-time pain to remind Todd that he had refused to take the shot. But he didn't scream out. There was a significant amount of heavy-duty wincing, I was told. About 20 minutes later, Doc was armed with all the information he was looking for. No bones were broken. No surgery would be required. All he had to do was pull the arm out from the body, twist it a little bit, and let it snap back into its socket. This is a procedure that is usually done under the influence of drugs. But Todd still refused. So two of us, held Todd from behind while Doc, using almost all of his strength, pulled the arm out and toward the socket joint until we heard that audible snap as it popped back into place. I don't know what Todd felt. I know I felt it in my shoulder. I saw Doc rubbing his a little bit. For his part, Todd just sat there. His face was contorted. There were now little rivulets in the dirt on his face. But he hadn't screamed. And his eyes held an incredible, stubbornness? Resolve? No. What I saw in Todd's eyes was peace. We didn't need to keep him overnight. Doc gave him the lowdown on how to treat the injury, told him he was going to be sore for quite a while. Doc offered to give him a few pills to take the edge off at night, but that offer was rejected just as adamantly as the shot was. Pills too, I thought. I helped Todd out the door into the car, told him not to ever come back again. That was my usual witty send-off. When I turned around, Doc had his hands in his pocket. He just shook his head and he said, "I'm going to go finish my dessert." I looked up and I noted for the record that there was no moon in the sky that night at all. I was almost done cleaning up when the phone rang. It was Todd's mother. I gave her the whole story. At the end of the conversation, she wanted to know if Todd had given us any trouble. You know, mothers do that. I couldn't resist telling her about his refusal to take the shot. And you know, that would have been the entire story, except for what she told me next. And what she told me next has forever changed the way I look at things. You see, some things are just black and white, right? I mean, the facts are staring you in the face, and it is so easy to make a decision that a puppy dog could do it, right? You remember the prophet Samuel had that kind of that same situation when he was sent out to Jesse's farm to have a look at the boys because God had told him that one of them was going to be anointed king. And so all the sons were lined up one by one, and they were paraded by, and something about Eliab caught Samuel's attention, and he thought, "Surely the Lord's anointed is standing before me." But though the facts seemed incontrovertible to Samuel, he was wrong. The Lord whispered in Samuel's ear, "Don't look on his appearance or the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. The Lord does not see as a man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart." It was God's whisper in the voice of Todd's mother who helped me put a period to the end of the story. She told me how very proud she was of her 16-year-old son, the decisions that he had been making in his life. She asked me if Todd had mentioned where he had been just the week before, but he hadn't. "Well," she said, "one week ago today, Todd was released from a drug recovery center in Arizona after a 7-year battle with drugs. Do the math, he was 16. 7 years. He had been certified drug-free for 1 week. And she said, "I am positive that he was more scared of what that drug would do to his body than he was about the pain." And then, with a palpable pride, she says, "I just thought you'd like to know." Got me. Just hit me. You know, I've lived long enough that I've seen people change over time. I've seen my little babies grow up and head off for academy and college and out into the world, and now they have little babies of their own. I have seen some fools become wise, And I have seen some proud people humbled. But only once have I seen a 16-year-old wimp transformed into a powerful hero as quickly as I did that night. I picked up the phone and I punched three numbers and I said, "Hey, Doc, I'll bet you'd like to hear the rest of the story." Every now and then, when you least expect it, God is going to lean down and he's going to whisper in your ear. And he will say things like, "Life is precious, but it is not yours. You can take it, but you cannot give it back. I am giving you opportunities. Make your decisions while you can." And he'll whisper, "How beautiful on the mountains are the feet of those who bring good news. Go and tell someone what you know. You don't need a fancy message or an experience. You just need to tell them what God has done for you." And he'll say, "I see things differently. I have all the facts. You look at the outward appearances, and I look on the heart. Look to me. Listen to me. I will guide you in all your ways. I will help you interpret the facts. Put your trust in me." You see, sometimes God whispers in a voice that can be heard clear across the Mississippi at flood stage, because some whispers aren't whispers at all. Until the clouds are gone, we cannot see the sun in glory shining overhead. But God holds out a helping hand to me and leads me through dark ways that I must tread. Until earth's sounds are hushed, it's hard to hear the whispers of God's low, still, silent voice. But in mercy, he leans toward my ear and whispers words that makes my heart rejoice.